So this is the session on the work of Martin Vaughn James. The occasion is the publication of this book, Elephant and the Projector. These are two volumes that have been were originally published in the 1970s and are republished by New York Review Comics. The gentleman to my left, Seth, designed the book, and the gentleman to his left, Sean Rogers, provided a lot of research, and my name is GTR. I wrote the introduction. So I'm just going to just briefly go over who Martin Vaughn James is, and then we can have a sort of conversation. He was born in 1943 in England, I think one thing that he mentions in interviews is the sort of post-apocalyptic feeling of his youth. He was in that part of England which was very heavily bombed, that's a big visual kind of influence. His family was very peripatetic. They ended up in Australia, where he kind of started reading Mad magazine, and that was also a kind of influence. He ended up in Australia, I believe he married his wife, the poet Sarah McLaughlin.
McCoy.
They moved to Canada in the sort of late 60s, and in Canada, he took up a kind of brief but very important career as a cartoonist, initially doing a sort of self-published work called Elephant, a kind of what we would now call the sort of pamphlet comic, staple, in alignment with Kochel's Books, which is a very important Canadian independent publisher, very much at the forefront of the book as a physical object. He started to do a series of books, including The Projector, The Park, and The Cage. And The Cage was recently, well not recently, but within the last decade, reprinted by Kochel's. And this brings two others of his work. I think there's a couple of things to say about Martin Vaughn James, which we'll see from his art, and if you can see in the book. He did very experimental, sort of non-narrative, sequential work. He was very influenced by the tradition of surrealism, which has roots in the early 20th century, but enjoyed a resurgence in the 1960s for reasons we can discuss later. But then he was also influenced by the French experimental novel, with the tradition of focusing on physical objects, really existing in some ways from isolation from comics. This is not stuff that you would buy in the one comic book store in Toronto at that time was Captain George's Whiz Bang. We don't want to talk about Captain George. No. But he, this is like, done by an experimental independent press. And in some ways a figure of isolation, but I think that there are some traditions that one could connect him to. One is very clearly the influence of underground comics and their kind of push of the art form. The tradition of the illustrated book that he was very aware of. The tradition of Canadian avant-garde work in the 1970s, especially at Kochel's, with people like B.P. Nichols, who also kind of did comics. And maybe like the sort of tradition of Canadian avant-garde, I think Sean might comment on this, someone like Michael Snow. The filmmaker who actually died recently, but did a lot of like sort of non-narrative work that was very focused on architectural space. So that's just a brief survey. But I want to open it up to my fellow panelists. Where would you guys sort of situate him? Because this is, in a lot of ways, a very perplexing body of work. Like if you go yeah. through it. It's something that you're going to have to live with for a long time, because it doesn't lend itself to easy understanding. What's the sort of context for you understanding this
work? Well, it's a remarkable body of work in that it is like really unprecedented for the time when it came out. And beyond that, it's extremely odd work. When I encountered it probably in the 1980s or early 90s, I was at the St. The Rosedale Library, and Charlie, he got all excited and told me there were two volumes in of The Projector and The Cage, and he was looking at me like I knew what he was talking about, and I was just went with it. I was like, oh, well, that's really great. Let's see. And he had a pile of them, and I bought one of each, and they were beautiful books, but I was perplexed entirely by them. I didn't know what the context of these books were at the time, and And the interesting thing about it is, outside of a context, they seem to be completely unique books from the early 70s. But the funny thing is there is a context. It's just the context is not really the world of comics that I was used to. You can make a connection between his work and the underground comics. I think certainly Von James was aware of like Mad Mag, or of like Crumb and Zap and things like that. But it's not a direct influence. You don't look at it and see like, oh, this is another underground comic. It certainly got like an artsy finish to it. And you immediately recognize it's coming out of the art world more than, certainly when you got started with The Cage. It's like, this is from the art world, maybe even the picture book world. But then when you see the earlier books, it's very clear that he was interested in comics. Like these books are very much, you can see more direct influence from the underground comics. He's using certain human figures, funny animal figures, things like this. Even though the artwork is very precise and distancing, it doesn't have the warmth that you see from like the underground comics of people like Crumb or Kim Deitch or even Moscoso, who's a bit like, yeah, you know, with the abstraction.
Yeah, I'd say it's more from the Moscoso end of things. It's almost like he's looking at certain artists like Moscoso, Robert Williams, even there's a bit of Greg Irons in the projector with the crowd scenes, and saying, okay, well, this is something that they're doing, I can bring this into my work. But something, I think of Moscoso and Williams certainly as more cold or cerebral, as cerebral as you can get in the underground.
I think maybe the early 70s interest in photorealist art has a lot to do with it too.
No.
You mentioned Michael Snow, but you could probably throw like Jack Chambers in there, or even, you know, like even Colville or something. They were really working with a kind of like flat, emotionally flat kind of thing that's supercharged. You look at like, even, you know, like, I don't think Edward Hopper is involved in any way, but that's an image everybody knows. These kind of distant images that you're not trying to like make them emotionally charged, but there's something coming up from it. You're very distant and cold. But there is, like, when you read through the book, you cannot help but feel the investment he's putting into physical objects. They're not just drawings of like buildings and cameras. They're characters in some strange way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a mixture of, going back to the surrealist influence, there's a mixture between kind of the organic and the mechanical, a juxtaposition between kind of hard lines and soft lines that is everywhere in the work.
Yeah, it's hard to think of what he was thinking of and Kochaus as an audience for these books. Because I can't imagine, I mean, beyond the sort of hippie intellectual world of 1973 Toronto, which would have been a pretty small world, like you mentioned B.P. Nichols, I wonder if Von James had any like kind of grandiose ideas that these books would find an audience or not. Do you have any idea?
I really don't know either, other than, as you say, there is a kind of community of like-minded artists and poets and book artists.
And he was young and enthusiastic.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, he kind of did find some sort of connection with people because one of the things that we included in this book is a poem written by Michael Ondaatje, who was a poet with Kochaus and who wrote a poem about the projector, sort of inspired by it. So clearly that was a kind of audience, and he did, there was like, this was a sort of, you know, golden age of arts funding in Canada, and so he did actually get funding. He got like an exhibit for a big show at the Art Gallery of Ontario in like 1975. Some of his like more illustrative work was picked up by Saturday Night, so I do feel like he, you know, even though he would never identify himself as a Canadian artist, like he was very international in his outlook, the kind of nurturing of the avant-garde that briefly existed in Canada, you know, from you know, like let's say the first 5 years of Trudeau-mania, basically, post 1967. I mean, he clearly benefited from that, and that did provide a kind of nurturing context and a readership of some sort, of a fellow artist, if no one else.
But I think we mentioned Kochaus a couple times already. One of the other connections that he makes a little bit after these books is with going to Paris and working on The Cage and working with Édition de Minuit, and that's where he gets a lot of his French readers, and that's who really kind of saves this work, I think, in a way. Publishers like Futuropolis and cartoonists like Schwitman Peters, who are, you know, Schwitman Peters actually put him in one of their comic stories as a kind of in a photographic sequence. He's a star of their book.
In some ways, he makes a bit more sense when you think of the European scene at that time. You can imagine him in France at that rise of Metal Hurlant and a lot of experimental science fiction going on at that time. And when you read The Cage especially, you're reminded of 70s experimental science fiction. People like Moorcock or Langdon Hughes, or these people who were doing...
The British New Wave. And I mentioned Ballard as well, which I think is like a very strong influence. Like, J.G. Ballard, just a little bit older than Martin Vaughn James, but you know, famously was in a Japanese internment camp in Hong Kong.
Yeah,
as a child, which he wrote about in his famous novel, Empire of the Sun. And if you read Ballard's work, it's a kind of prose version of Martin Vaughn James, in the sense that there's a lot of, like, you know, destroyed buildings, empty swimming pools, you know, like just a post-apocalyptic environment where nothing is really explained. I think that's the sort of commonality of experience.
Yeah, something like the Atrocity Exhibition too by Ballard, where it's fragmentary and it's mashing together these kind of this detritus from pop culture, like, you know, Ronald Reagan and JFK and cars and advertising. And it's a very similar experience to reading something like The Projector, for sure.
It's interesting too, you've got to look at it like in the context of the times too, that it's very much, there is a hippie aesthetic here too. I mean, this, all of his books are definitely anti-establishment. They're very much like late 60s, early 70s thoughts about consumerism and how we're being crushed by a mechanical culture. At the same time, like New York Review Books just recently put out the Soft City book.
Yeah, Push Wagner.
Push Wagner. Yeah. And when you read that, you can see, even though that wasn't published for years later, it was drawn contemporarily.
Yeah.
And that is a similar kind of anti-society, we're all being turned into robots kind of aesthetic. There's an NFB film from 1974 called Hunger, which is maybe the first computer animated cartoon, and it's like, aesthetically, I feel like there's a real connection too.
Yeah.
And that's about consumption and the same sort of, this, I think it's the, you know, part of that flowering of the recognition of corporate culture taking over the society.
I do want to jump in on, because I had mentioned the surrealist before, and I mean, one of the sort of clues to where he's coming from is there's a quote, I think it's in The Projector, right, of from André Breton. And so there's like the early, and he was very interested in the early 20th century surrealists, and these were perhaps the most political of the avant-garde. It was very much associated with the anti-Stalinist left and with Trotskyism in the 20s and 30s, and that movement sort of went into abeyance in mid-century, but enjoyed a real revival in the 60s, reappropriated by people like the Situationists, again, for the sort of rising political consciousness of the 60s, and had a, you know, in Europe had a big influence on things like the Paris Uprising in 68. A lot of the themes of this work and a lot of the imagery of this work is also in Martin Vaughn James, and it perhaps explains why he eventually ended up moving to France.
Yeah. With the surrealist influence in the Projector, there's, I mean, visual quotes of Magritte, there's visual quotes of Dalí and Buñuel, like the famous priest sequence from Jean Dou. But in terms of like the politics of it, or, you know, deriving a kind of political bent from those models of the surrealist or the situationist, I feel like what's interesting about Vaughn James is that, yes, he is kind of anti-consumerist, anti-capitalist, in a way that a lot of the kind of hippie art is of the time, but he's also kind of a little bit anti-counterculture. Like, in The Projector, there's a big crowd scene where a lot of hippies and people are having a party, and one of the quotes that somebody says is, graffiti isn't a strategy, right? That seems pretty pointedly anti-situationist. And then it seems almost like the protagonist wants to escape from that party, from that world. I mean, Vaughn James was, he didn't do drugs. You know, I don't know to what degree he was really felt at home in that countercultural moment.
Yeah, no, he seemed like a square, which is one of the reasons I really like him. You know, if it's one thing that is not dated well, it's hippies. But speaking of, I'm going to take over for a second here, because speaking of, you know, like art movements, and there's an ad that for The Elephant when it came out, which is an early book, And I'm going to read you this. It's a little long, but it's like this pretty much puts him in context. So he's still young enough that he's kind of explaining his work here, which he would not be doing later, I don't think. He definitely stood back and let people make up their own minds. But just be reminded, this is an ad attempting to sell the book. You wouldn't make an ad like this now. He says, this is Ron James speaking, the age of reason has inflicted man with an asphyxia of the mind. We live in an age of corporate bodies. We experience collectively customs on a national scale. Any deviation is considered neurotic, insane, or subversive. Our individual vision has been sacrificed for an amazingly limited range of collective perceptions, which we learn from childhood in repetition and limitation, the way a parrot learns to swear. Our society believes in words, not people or things. We are abstract. When we perceive an object or person or feeling, we see a word first, and if we are not already too far gone, the thing later. Our world is no longer populated with trees and storms and stones and blood, but the words trees, stones, storm, blood. Our mania for equality and our for quality and affluence achieved throughout systems of logic, order, has meant that we must reject our natural chaos and accept the same way of perceiving the so-called real world. Elephant is not a fantasy. The modern world is a fantasy. The fantasy of our reason, our logic, our insistence, our problems and solutions. Elephant is a man living subjectively, ideologically, and mysteriously. Elephant is a confused whisper in a corridor of steam irons and bank buildings. Elephant is a heart in a cardboard box, its beat almost inaudible as it stands in an empty parking lot. And of course, I'm sure everyone ran out and bought the book immediately after. But I mean, that pretty much encapsulates what the young Bon James was thinking the point of his work was. So clearly he was, you know, he had an agenda in this work, and he was working hard to put it forward. And you can see that progression in the books, that it becomes more refined, and he obviously becomes less willing to explain that to people.
Yeah, no. I mean, it is interesting to read the four, if you can get the four books together, read them in sequence, because you do actually see, like, an artist that he is working to refine his work, to, like, you know, first he's bringing together a bunch of influences, then shedding stuff that he doesn't like. You know, the underground stuff, he kind of, like, loses some of that.
He does.
More overt, you know, references to Crumb and whatnot, and then really it becomes more and more sort of extreme. He's a kind of very serious artist. I think the difference between him and the undergrounds are perhaps worth spelling out a little bit more. I mean, as mentioned, you know, he didn't do drugs. Big difference. Like you know, like Crumb and all those guys, you know, like their visions are coming out of drugs. They were like, you know, like real community, like, you know, like they came from all over America, Texas, the East Coast, but they all ended up in San Francisco. They were like, you know, and they had like three or four publishers, and they had a distribution network, which he didn't have, right? Like, I don't know where the hell you would find the projector in like 1975, but they had head shops. Well, a brief-lived distribution network, but still, like, you know, you could go in and buy your bonds and your weed and your Zap comics.
Kind of like today.
Yeah, exactly. We brought them back. And also, but more importantly, the form of the underground comics was a fetish item. Like, it's basically coming out of the fact that Robert Crumb, you know, like, really loved the sort of comics that he had as a 10-year-old, the Walt Disney comics and stories, Little Lulu, and, you know, like, took the pamphlet form, staple, like, the very much a comic form, which you see a little bit of in Martin Von James in the first book, but really, he's interested in bookmaking, and that's a real difference. And, like, I think some of the underground stuff, especially, they get collected.
If you look at this, like, he's very interested in the form of the book.
Yeah, he's dealing with page spreads in a way that underground comics were never concerned with how the book read. Yeah. I mean, things are slapped together.
Yeah.
Often not even sure what page a story might be starting on.
Yeah, and the codex, the bound book, the physical object, and especially with Kochas, a real concern with, like, sort of printing and, like, you know, like to get a physical object that exists rather than, I mean, I think the appeal of the underground is that it's a, you know, 50-cent thing that you can, you know, get and smoke up and just enjoy it in a very casual way, with a sort of fetishistic connection to the comic book pamphlet form. And he's not very much interested in that. And I think the only underground cartoonists who became interested in the book form are really like Francois Mouly and Art Spiegelman, mm-hmm. with Breakdowns in 77 and Raw. And they're the ones that kind of bring in the book aesthetic into comics.
You see it a bit in the underground comics. Somebody like Moscoso is a good example. Like, his comics often altered the format, made them small, whatever. And you could see he wanted to make a book. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that the underground press ever really embraced the idea of the seriousness of a book. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the funny thing about these books by Von James, is that they are clearly serious from the get-go. Mm-hmm. I mean, even Elephant, which is saddle-stitched, he's got like a die-cut cover, and he's made up a terrible name for what this new medium he's invented.
He says it was forced on him by his publisher.
Does he? Oh, thank God. But he proudly announces it in the first one. It is a book and a movie combined, so the new form is called a boovie. That's pretty bad. Although, and it may be even worse than graphic novel. But at least it shows you, though, that he was automatically thinking, like, I'm trying to create a new form. I'm trying to do something that's radically different, even though he wasn't divorcing himself entirely from comics. Mm-hmm. Although you notice the word comic is not in that new made-up word. It's books and movies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's something to say about the history of that sort of graphic novel before it coalesced, which is that, like, you know, going back to the early 19th century, every 15 or 20 years, somebody gets the idea, let's put together a bunch of drawings into a narrative form in a book, and, you know, like, let's do it. Like Topher, the woodcut novel, you know, these, even in the early 1950s with some of the comic book guys.
It's almost every 10 years.
So, but it never really coalesced. There's never, like, a sort of critical mass of people.
You make the point, it's almost always in isolation.
Yeah,
right? It's constantly somebody reinventing the idea.
I think each of the people literally did think they reinvented it. They weren't aware of the predecessors. Mm-hmm. Maybe the woodcut guys all knew that each other were doing woodcut novels, but even 10 years after that, you've got woodcut novels by people who don't seem aware of the previous woodcut novels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, exactly. It's like, I sort of, in my introduction, call it a phoenix form. Like, it's constantly being reborn, dies. And it's really only after Martin Von James that in the late 70s with, like, you know, unfortunately Will Eisner's A Contract with God, and then later Mouse and...
Mouse, to some degree, it's like, even though everybody, Mouse was like, everybody was aware of Mouse, but Mouse did not start a sudden cascade of graphic novels. It took about another 10 years until it really took off.
Even though
everybody was aware, here's a graphic novel, I'm going to try and make a graphic novel. Suddenly publishers didn't say it has arrived.
It took a concerted effort by a bunch of different artists and publishers, including like Drawn and Quarterly, especially with like sort of actively lobbying bookstores and libraries to have a graphic novel section. Mm-hmm. So like once you could like kind of create the category, then all these things could be joined together. But like Martin Von James is the last person operating outside of, you know, that context. Like by the late 70s, you are seeing people, even though it's very few people, and a lot of the work is, you know, like Gil Kane's His Name is Savage or whatever, you know, the Chandler novel done by Sternicko. Like, it's not like, I would not say any of this is great
There's
work.
A couple of handful things from the underground press, too, like George Metzger put out a graphic novel. But they're all aware of the world of comics. These people were suddenly, there was something they were collectively aware of. Von James would be the last guy, I think, before that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With Von James, I think the precursors are almost more like Max Ernst's feature novels, or something like Dino Buzzati's comic novel, which is also published by New York Review of Books. Mm-hmm. People who are working well outside of the realm of cartooning and trying to accomplish something different. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wonder if Von James would be gratified to see this attention paid now, or if he'd think that it ended up in the wrong place. I mean, we're at a comic book convention. It's like, I mean, this is still an artsy kind of talk, but on some level, I mean, it's hard to perceive, to look back, and he didn't do that many interviews, so to perceive exactly what his goals were with this book.
Well, I mean, he spent after The Cage, you know, there are a few kind of comics projects that he worked on.
He did a bunch of shorts pieces.
Short pieces, which are really good.
I got them all off the internet a couple of years ago.
But spent the rest of his life as a painter and a novelist. So I would think that would be kind of his milieu that he would want to be remembered in, but we've kind of glommed onto him here in comics.
Well, I don't know his paintings, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say that this was probably the more unique work. I mean, even if he was doing the same kind of work in paintings, that, you know, those are just graphic images. Yeah. This is actually quite remarkably original work.
Yeah, this is, he's so breaking new
the
ground
test
here
of time.
In a way
yeah.
that he couldn't do in painting.
Yeah. And maybe his paintings were great, I don't know. Yeah. But I haven't seen them, which tells me something.
Yeah. I mean, they were good, but they're in the same vein as Chambers and maybe somebody like Gerhard Richter or something like that.
No, this is like a very unique kind of body work, especially as he goes along. I think the cage is probably like the kind of masterpiece.
But another thing you talk about is the production values of those early books. Yes. They were beautifully produced. I mean, when we made this book, we tried to give some impression of the beauty of that printing, too, to keep the original sense of the textures and tones of the paper he used, color that he, you know,
I think it's a pretty good facsimile of
I mean, it'll never be exactly like they're unique books on their own and well worth seeking out. But I was really gratified to work on this project because it's nice to get, you know, it's funny, even though, you know, you could just go on Abe Books and buy his books, having a new book out of something brings a new audience. Mm-hmm. People will see it for the first time. Even if you were to do, like, even, you know, how many people would just go out after this talk and immediately go and seek out an out-of-print book? It's hard, you know, it's a specific thing. Some people will do it, a few. But a new book will bring a new audience, and that's the point of republishing it. I mean, it's not like you can't find out-of-print books. I mean, all the books we're talking about from the early 20th century, these once-every-10-year graphic novels, you can go on Abe Books and buy them for $15. It's like they're not, it's not obscure in the way things were in the past. I mean, I had a list of books that I was looking for before the computer that it's like I was looking for decades. And then the computer came and I got them that week. it's like things are out there. It's just a matter, it was a matter of finding them. Well, now things, like the history of printing is pretty accessible, but you still have to get people interested in it. And that's why it's still important to have new editions of people's work.
I mean, I guess that brings up a question is what, if anything, is Von James's legacy in comics? Is it still to come with the recent republication of this book in the cage, or can we see some people having familiarized themselves with the work already and really taken it to heart?
I don't, myself, I would say that I don't think he's left a big footprint on the cartoonists of today. I feel like the graphic novel of today has a different history of where it's coming from. Von James is an arc that went off and that most of the cartoonists of my generation and beyond did not know about. I knew the underground cartoonists as I got older, but I mean, most cartoonists of my generation came out of the junk culture, came out of Mad Magazine and Marvel Comics. When you see a work like this, you realize like how profoundly affecting it would be, but then I remember how perplexed I was when I first saw it. I think the younger generation of today of cartoonists would be less perplexed. They've experienced a lot more different types of cartooning, and I think Von James could have potentially new fans that it could have an effect on. In fact, you know, you see a lot of the art comics that young people are doing today, a lot of them are non-narrative, a lot of them are graphically really experimental. I think that they, Von James would have got along just fine with these people.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, I mean, I think in the context of Kramer Zergot, this book makes a lot more sense.
I could see Sammy republishing this in Kramer's for sure.
Yeah.
The park.
But I would also maybe emphasize a sort of theoretical influence. Like, I think a lot of, like, in Europe particularly, a lot of French academics have been very interested in this book and have written about it. And that sort of theoretical interest bleeds over into sort of artistic practice. Like, so I would imagine if there is an influence, it's more likely to be in European comics.
It's great for academics because it's completely, they can make up anything they want about it, and they can suck him dry for their career.
The conquest of space.
But as you say, maybe we have 15 minutes left. I think we can talk a lot more on this. If people have questions, it's an odd series, it's an odd body of work, but there would be some...
Yep, I knew it. No, it's different. Yeah, sure.
Me?
Yes.
Would you say like there's a difference? I know it's not really the point for darkness, but would you say one is more like Hergé's depiction of way of viewing Tintin? That's like one line for this, one line for that. Next one, the character is something else. With the big books you reprinted in New York Review books.
I didn't understand like, that like, question. Could you ask again?
Like one, it had like you can see the face more and you can understand it, like what the character's thinking. The other one, that's not really the point. Like I say, that's the difference between the two books.
Oh, do you mean between his earlier work and his later work?
Yeah, there's a character in the
Certainly, it is interesting to see like as he kind of evolves away from using human characters. Yeah. Like it's funny in the first couple of books, there is an underground aesthetic because you see images of like. This male figure he uses a lot. It's sort of a bit of an establishment figure. But sometimes this figure might like have a toilet for a head. You know, there's completely odd, out of the blue kind of imagery. But it's funny still. There's still a sense of humor to what he's doing. As you move into the later books, it's more like you said, there's like a kind of an abandonment of the human figure. In fact, I don't think there is a human figure in the cage at all.
No,
there's a horse.
Stand-ins for the
human figure. And he does do a lot of stuff where he uses machines to stand in for human elements. Like in the cage, for example, he's got like cameras, tape recorders, things like this that are clearly sensory objects. Mm-hmm. And they get bound together sometimes with string and stuff. You can feel like these are being magnetically pulled together somehow in space and tied together into figures of some sort. Mm-hmm. They're very strange narratives. And like, I remember going through the book once and really trying to nail down, what is this book about? Like writing down, okay, this is obviously this, and this is obviously that. Expecting at the end I got to the book, I would have like this answer. Okay, so here it is. It's about time melding and blah, blah, blah. But at the end I was like, nope, there is not a simple answer to this book. That's why I think reading the book is not about understanding, at least with the cage. It's about experiencing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is an experience you have when you read the book. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I think that the Hergé reference is very interesting in the sense of there's a blankness to the sort of human figure.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You're supposed to look like Tintin, just it's a kind of everyman figure. Although obviously that's not, that's already gendered, but still, you kind of, with the blank eyes, you're supposed to read into it. And it's interesting that he goes from a blank figure to no humans at all. Mm-hmm. But where there's a human element, or not human element, at least characterization, is the sort of anthropomorphic funny animals, which are very much in the sort of underground tradition of taking Disney, I think it's the Three Little Pigs from the Disney cartoon in the 30s,
where
Tony
Gone
Pirates, to Seed.
possibly.
So it's interesting that he that is something that he decides he does not need, in his later work, that he can do without character.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You also get the feeling he didn't know what he was doing.
Yeah.
And he admits it.
Yeah.
He says, I don't have an answer either. Sure.
I swear that he, there was a European album that he contributed to called The Leaning Girl. You heard of that one?
Yeah, that's he's in that one.
I feel like that's I don't know, Hitchcock, decades later explaining what silent films are about. If you want a pat answer for, what his career, what he thought his career was, that is it. And it makes his older books.
I've not seen this. What's it about?
It has, there's a narrative about a girl, but his thing is basically, I don't know the whole narrative, but his part's just, kind of a Hal Foster thing where there's a human figure and he's drawing or painting something. He's almost done.
Okay.
And it's just it feels like he thought his work was about creativity, which is very pat in a way. But I think that's what it was for him.
Do you know this work, Sean?
This is the Schwieten and Peters book that I was talking about, City Obscure. It's part of that series.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you want to continue talking?
Right.
No,
question.
Go ahead.
No.
Have you ever attempted to publish the part, too?
Yeah, I want that.
Oh, are we thinking of trying to republish it? I would love to republish it, but, it depends.
Everybody has to buy 5 copies of this
book.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a wonderful piece.
It is a wonderful piece.
Yeah.
And, it's a very small piece.
The short stories that he did after The Cage were collected in French in a book called After the Battle, which is also very, very good, very tough to find, but it's short pieces. I think the part would go well with that book. But,
I think it's a miracle this book exists.
Yeah,
I don't know what the people of the New York
Review. I love those people because every book they put out is a miracle. Who are they? Speaking of Ron James wondering who their audience is, that's what I think with their catalog.
Yeah.
I'm like, are there really enough people who are interested in this work? And I am grateful they believe that because it's so great to see the books.
And also, I'm a cartoonist and I'm once by Ron James,
Great.
Yeah.
I am from the Jungle.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I know that lots of stuff like this can be influenced by things like dreams. Like, a lot of this is reminding me of the internet animator David Firth's work, like the guy who made Salad Fingers, and a lot of okay. this stuff is maybe inspired by his dreams. You know, if he left any... Mobius, I think, also
yeah. Sean, do you know?
I unfortunately don't.
No. Yeah, I was going to say, I've read a few comments from him. He certainly talked about the fact that he was not concerned with building a narrative while he was working on it. Mm-hmm. He was working somewhat spontaneously, I think, page to page. But I don't think I can recall any specific, you know, reference to how he structured, how he, you mm-hmm. know, how this came down onto the page, what he was doing.
He calls the projector, I've got it written down here, an image-producing train on rails, and he thought of the cage in the same way as a kind of machine that produces images, right? That he doesn't need to come up with a narrative to drive the story, that he has locations certain recurring images, like the things wrapped in cloth and plants and typewriters and so on, and that just rearranging those in different iterations is what can create and drive what we see on the page.
It is interesting that he was so fixated on this idea of the machine, mm-hmm. too. It's clearly at the center of most of his work. Mm-hmm. And in the cage, isn't the center the pumping station?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The here in Toronto. Mm-hmm. Where is that? Which one is
it? It's on Poplar Plains Road. It's just northwest of here.
Yeah. And it's like a very accurate rendition of it. It's like, and it feels like that is a machine sort of at the center of the story that is somehow spinning out this gravitational waves of images. I think of the book as a big vortex kind of, with like things coming to the center. But you do feel like that, I suspect that he had these kind of vague notions himself, like you say, like as a projector, and then just followed them where they kind of illogically led. Mm-hmm.
The one thing I will say about the process is that if you look at the books in sequence, it's clear that he like does a sort of short experimental work and then he refines it. So like I see the elephant and projector as like the projector is like taking what he learned from working on elephant and like doing a more polished version. Mm-hmm. And the same with the park and the cage. I really encourage people to read the two in conjunction. The park reads like a sort of trial run, like let's see like how this would work. Sort of like you know, an artist sketching out something.
Yeah.
And then, so to me that indicates that's where the deliberation is, like in terms of like trying to see what you can get away with and then doing a more elaborate, ambitious version of that. Mm-hmm.
I kind of wonder, like, when you read the books at the end, if he felt he'd creatively come to an end.
Yeah.
Like, that there was, like, that's as far as he could go. Because it is odd that that's the end of it, basically, except for those few short pieces, which are, again, in the same vein. It's like, part of me feels like there is kind of a creative end there. It's like, I'm not sure how much further down that road of surrealist abstraction he could have gone. Yeah.
But actually, I'm going to challenge that because in the interview with Canadian Literature, he was asked if there's any limits to the visual novel. And he said, limits? I don't think so. The possibilities of the form are very large to me. There's a lot more things to be done.
But he left that to us.
He left that to other people, yeah. I think we can maybe have one more question and where we should...
This has been fascinating for me because I worked at Coach House and I came to Coach House in 1974. I worked there from 1980 to 1982. And at the time, you have to remember Coach House was 401A Huron, which means it was right in the shadow of Rochdale. So there you found Judy Merrill, who was the great pipeline to science fiction to Toronto. There he meets B.P. Nichol and he becomes friends with Greg Curnow, who also is an artist.
I was thinking of Greg Curnow.
Yeah, and he was drawing bicycles, and he was drawing objects as well.
And they did those two Coach House editions of the Big Little Books with Curnow, which I'm not sure if they were before or after, though. Were they before?
I think they were 70.
I think they're before, but I will say that one of the legacies of Coach House was that Stan Beddington and his crew, including me, were really, really interested in the book as an object, and I'm really glad that you guys... pick up on that, and I'm really glad that you're here celebrating these books because very few people have mentioned Martin Vaughn James. When I worked in comics, I was pushing it on to people like editors like Archie Goodwin and people like Alan Moore.
Well, clearly Archie Goodwin was very moved.
But Will Eisner, they were all aware of him.
Yeah. That's interesting.
And so he did have an impact. Yeah. But I think you're right. It was just more like a, oh, well, that was interesting.
Yeah.
And away it went. But
Eisner probably reported him to the FBI.
I just wanted to thank you guys because this was fun for me having
that's nice, Mark.
Part of that.
Yeah. I didn't realize you were at Cochos, Mark.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. That was very good.
And just to wrap up with the on the hippie theme, I mean, maybe... he might not have used drugs, but the guys at Cochas certainly did. In fact, in their books, in Cochas' books in the 70s, in the initiate, it says, printed by mindless acid freaks at Cochas' books.
Didn't Stan start by printing Canada flags on tabs of acid?
I can't confirm or deny that.
I hope that's true.
Just a bit of an addendum. So the colophon did read printed by mindless acid freaks.
Yeah.
And that was so that we could tell whether or not the ink was working. And secondly, on my first day at work, I was gone. I went to the refrigerator. It opened up and they said, this is the original Owsley acid from 1968. When you really need it, it's there. I never needed it.
One
last. Just really quickly, is the book available here this weekend?
Yeah. Should be.
Peter will know.
New York Review Comics, the publisher of Elephant and Projector, does have a table. And I carry a big stack of books for us.
First floor? Okay.
First floor, everyone can now. Thank you, Seth and John. It's really great conversation.